This is Stuart Connor talking.
I'm sitting here in the Deaconess Hospital lunchroom with Walter Woodcock, who's visiting his son in town right now.
Walter and I have known each other for quite a few years, but haven't seen each other for several years. But we both had a lot of interesting experiences with some sites that have Crow beliefs, and we're going to tape some of these right now. And we'll start out and by asking Walter if he'd tell me about his experiences with Joe Medicine Crow at the Hoodoo pictographs or petroglyphs down on Hoodoo Creek close to Bighorn Canyon. Go ahead, Walt.
Okay. Thank you, Stu. I was area chief appraiser at the time, and Joe Medicine Crow was on my staff. And we had taken a group of assignments up in the Dryhead Country. And we were driving my personal car on this trip. It was an old Plymouth, the one that, because that's rough country and you don't dare take a good car back in there away from and off of the trails. And so we had been back in the country a few hours. It came lunchtime and we stopped the car to have our lunch. And as we were sitting on the ground looking out over the canyon, I said to Joe, "What's the name of this creek?" "Oh," he said, "that's Hoodoo Creek." And I said, "Well, how did it get its name?" "Well," Joe said, "down below us on the canyon wall, there's an inscription." And he said, "Those who have viewed the inscription, which is a face on the wall, and if the face would change expression, they were due for some pretty lousy luck." And then he described all the gruesome things that had happened to various people who had seen this face on the wall change expression. So I said, "Gee, God, Joe, that's interesting. Let's go down and take a look at it." And he said, "Well, I can't do it." And I said, "Are you superstitious, Joe?" After all, Joe had a master's degree in anthropology. "No," he said, "I'm not particularly superstitious, but I have a grandmother that I am very fond of, and if she knew that I'd gone down and looked at the face on the walls, she wouldn't be very happy." So he said, "Well, if you want to go down and look at it, that's fine. I'll tell you how to get down there." So he stayed up on the brim of the canyon and guided me down, and I walked down this trail, kind of like an orphan Annie trail along the side of the canyon wall. And then I could see I had to go up, well, perhaps I think it was about 10 feet up kind of a little trail to this area that was a flat surface on the canyon wall, and then underfoot there was perhaps an area of 5 to 8 feet or something like that to stand on. And there before me was the famous inscription that Hoodoo Creek was named for. It was a circle, a rather large circle forming a face. The eyes were like turkey tracks, and unusually different from any other pictograph I'd ever seen. It had a smiling mouth. I'd never seen a pictograph with a smiling mouth before. And so I said, "Well, it's smiling at me and everything is all right." And so I got ready to leave. And rather than come up the trail that I had come by, it was easier to grab the shelf rock and just jump over the side. Well, as I jumped over the side, I looked back up at the inscription on the wall and it changed expression. And as I interpreted the reason for the expression to change is the way the light is coming down into the canyon and created a reversed image of the mouth as opposed to what was carved. And so I called to Joe and I said, the inscription changed expression. And he said, well, you better get on your hands and knees and be very careful because you're due for some hard luck. Well, I'm not, wasn't superstitious at least then. And I came back up and we got in the car and we went about our job and we were all day all over that area in my old Plymouth. And I imagine it was about 4:30 that we headed back. And Joe was tired and he had gone to sleep and I was driving across the kind of a swale. And all of a sudden the front end of the car just came up with a hell of a jar and down and it stopped, dead stopped. And I opened up the door and looked underneath the car and the oil was coming out of the pan. And the front wheel had picked up a flat rock and a flat rock had pushed right up into the oil pan and jammed the oil pan right into the crankshaft and boy, we were dead. And Joe came out of it and looked around and he said, well, we're back on Hoodoo Creek. Well, gosh, to walk out toward Hardin was an impossible journey. And Joe said, you know, I think we should walk back into the canyon. It's about 4 miles to a cow camp, which we did. I had my father-in-law's movie camera, and I had to carry that because I didn't want to leave it in the car, and we were pretty well loaded down with various things, and we drove we walked the 4 miles back to the cow camp. And we went into the camp, and there was a table with the plates all turned upside down on a table, nobody around, and a couple of beds in the back bedroom with tarped bedrolls on them. And I said, Joe, let's roll up on these beds and take a nap. And he said, well, you might be able to do it, but I'm Indian. If I did that and someone caught me in one of those beds, he'd shoot me. So I said, well, Joe, if you can't sleep on a bed, neither can I. So he crawled underneath the kitchen table and took a nap, and I went out and sat on the step by the front door, the only door. And as I was sitting there, suddenly I noticed the cowboy's hat back in the bushes, and he started to come my way, and also then he kind of walked over into the bushes, and I saw that he had a Jeep. So I thought, well, gosh, at least we're going to have some help getting out of here. And then the fellow came up to the house, and when I stood up, it startled him, and he wasn't at all happy to see us, and particularly Joel. And so I asked him if he'd help us out. I told him our problem. Then he said no. He said he had a girlfriend he wanted to go see that night, and he didn't have time to be fooling around with us. And so I offered him $40 if he would help us out. At that time, $40 was more than it is now. You know, that was a pretty good price, and all the money I had for that matter. And so anyway, he finally went, and he decided to go. Well, this cowboy had only one eye. And so we took off with the car, and he was cussing, and he was driving like everything with his one eye. And got to the car, and he just wasn't at all happy. And he had a short chain, and he tied on the back of my Plymouth with this short chain. And Joe would sit up in his car and try to help him, keep him from being too reckless. Well, he took off as fast as he could go with this Plymouth, and of course I didn't have compression, all I had was brakes, and I knew that they weren't going to last very long, and the road from there on down below was pretty hairy, and God, I was on that little short chain just going to beat hell. And finally we got down to the oiled highway, and the cowboy stuck his head in the window and he said, how you doing back here? And I said, I'm just doing fine. I wasn't going to complain then because there's oil all the way. Well, we went on into Hardin about 10 miles an hour. And so that's the way it was. I came back. And that's the story of the face on the canyon wall.
At Hoodoo Creek. At Hoodoo Creek?
At Hoodoo, the case on the canyon wall at Hoodoo Creek, yeah.
Walter, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that came up during the course of your very interesting discussion there. What's an Orphanani Trail?
Well, that's a canyon that is absolutely vertical above and vertical below, and how those trails in Orphanani's script were carved, I don't know, but...
How large was the face, Walt?
As I recall, it was probably 3 feet across.
Okay. And you said that you jumped over the side when you were going to leave. What do you mean by that?
From the trail up to where that ledge was, he could stand on, was perhaps 5 feet. Well, rather than to walk back around the trail that I came up on, it was either easier to just grab the sand rock that I was standing on and let myself over the side. And when I did that, I glanced back up at the face on the canyon wall, and that's when I saw it change expression.
I still don't understand. When you were leaving, you said you jumped over the side, did you go down?
Yes, I went down. I went down, yeah, to the trail. See, the trail came down, and then I had to go back up again to get to the inscription.
I see.
So that's why I went down.
Do you have any photographs of the Hoodoo face on the rims?
I tried to take one of Verl when I took him there, and I still have that, but the face didn't show up on the photo. Isn't that something?
Oh, wow. I've had experiences almost exactly like that.
Isn't that something?
When were you there with Joel?
I don't know. I'd have to study that to get that date on it. I have notes on that, I'm sure, but it'd be pretty hard because there's about a 10-year period in there that so many things happened. And well, it was in the 60s, mid-60s.
Okay, that's good enough for our purpose. If you have some notes that have any further details or anything, I'd really like to have a photocopy.
Okay, I'll do it.
And then, who was the cowboy, or who did he work for?
I don't know what that guy's name was, and he was one-eyed, and I don't remember who owned the cow camp. Joe Medicine Crow would know that, though. I don't know whether he would know the name of that cowboy, but he's identified as having one eye. I don't remember that very well.
Walt, I've heard Joe tell this same story too, and I really got a kick out of it. But I also remember one other group of BIA people in there and having almost the same kind of trouble. Rich Jaramillo was with them. I don't remember who else was offhand, Do you remember their experience?
I don't remember their experience, yeah. No.
Okay. You also told me years ago about your experience at Dinwiddie Lake, trying to camp out there overnight.
Oh, God.
And Joe told me some fascinating and pretty scary stories about things that have happened at Dinwiddie Lakes in May 1992 when we were driving down there. But unfortunately, he didn't seem to really want those to be tape recorded, or maybe it was just that he got to telling them when I was driving and didn't have the tape recorder out and ready. I don't know, but we did not get tapes of those particular stories. But he mentioned a little bit about your experience there, and you'd told it to me before, and I'd really appreciate it if you just tell us the whole thing.
Okay. Well, mine started out not really knowing about the mysteries of Dinwiddie. I was at the agency, and my stenographer at that time was Bertha Norman. And so I told Bertha that I would leave that morning and I would be gone all day appraising a right-of-way up to Burris, which is not too far from there. and that I wanted to try out my survival kit, so I thought that I would drive up to the end of Dinwiddie Lake and camp there for the night and try my survival kit out, and then I would come back the next day appraising various pieces of property and see her then. Well, when I went back in the office the next day, Bertha said, "Well, how was it in your camp at Dinwiddie?" And I said, "Well, I didn't camp there. I went back to the motel and lander," and she laughed and she said, "Well, I knew you would." Well, there's a lot I didn't know at that time about Dinwiddie, because when I got there with my survival kit and pulled up at the edge of the lake, I got out and built a little teepee of wood. I was going to build a fire and got my coffee pot out and put it on the back of the tailgate. And then I thought, well, before it gets dark, I'm going to walk back into the cave. This was a cave that the University of Wyoming had excavated a few years before. And so I walked back into the cave, and I was very tired, and I'd heard the stories about little people. Perhaps they were on my mind. But I walked back in there, and I was a little hesitant as I was going in, because it's dark, and there's just a shaft of light shining back in there, and you could see some things and other things you couldn't see. But I was standing there, and then all of a sudden I just felt very uncomfortable, and I came out, and I came out with a vision, and at least as far as I'm concerned, in my mind, I remember saw one of the little people, and there was a ledge on the back of the cave, and this little creature was sitting up there with little beady eyes. And whether this is real or not, maybe I just took a nap and dreamed this, but anyway, in my mind it seemed real. And so I went back to my campfire, and I thought, well, I'll get ready for camp. And I started to lay out, and then I'd hesitate, and I thought, man, I just feel uncomfortable as hell. And so finally I said, to hell with it, and I just threw all my stuff in the car and went back and got a room at the motel in Lander. Well, it was that caused me to do some exploring, and I was talking with some of the people, and I was talking with Mr. Miller, who lives along the river, just above there, and leased some land up in that area from the tribe. And he said that he had been out riding all day long, and he's coming home like I was, tired, and on his way down to the ranch, he came around the hill, which is just above where I was, and he spotted a cave. So he tied his horse up to a pine tree and walked back into this cave that he'd never seen before. And he said that in the cave he encountered, I think it was four Indians with hunting rifles, that he said he thought they'd gone back into the cave and built a fire to keep warm, and they burned up all the oxygen and died in there. And they were all dead, so he went home. Next day, you got the Indian police to take them back out there. And so when they rode around the hill to where the cave was, there just wasn't a cave. It didn't exist. So that was a kind of a hairy story. The other one, of course, has to do with the operator, and this is for irrigation. And I don't know the details of this, but they had a house where the water comes out of the lake for irrigation, and they had an awful time keeping people there. They would stay there for only a short time, and then they would leave. And then there's another story that has to do with that same area, that has to do with the Boy Scout leader. Now, this one, all I know is a hearsay, and perhaps it's some distance from there, but it's in the Wind River Mountains, and the Boy Scout leader took his pack into the into the mountains. And the kids came out, but the Boy Scout leader didn't, and the Indian police went in to get him, and they found him, but he was out of control. They couldn't handle him, and they put him in a forced cabin, locked him in with the idea they would go back and get a, what do you call it, they put a person in a...
Straitjacket?
A straitjacket, yeah, thanks, Duel. Anyway, they get a straitjacket for him, but when they got back, he had gotten out of the cabin, and he stripped his clothes. They found scattered clothes along the trail and finally found him dead. Now, the details of that have to come from some other, because that's a hearsay story. But then at that same time when I was there, one of the fellows who worked for the Forest Service was in that area. And all of a sudden, he had some problems, kind of like I was, very uncomfortable, and they found him up on a rock, batting a rock with his hat. And he said that the little people were after him. And then the one story that I can put together that I can understand was a packer. And he had come out of the mountains. And boy, when he told me this story, he was wide-eyed. He said, I didn't want anything to do with Dinwiddie Country, because he said he came in there and he threw his bedroll out on the ground and staked his horse out. And he said, in the middle of the night, all of a sudden, about 3 feet of water just came in and completely covered him. And he grabbed his pack and got the hell out of there, and he said he'd never go back again. Well, that story seemed like it's pretty far-fetched, but it has, there is an answer to that, because Dinwiddie Creek comes down and goes into a sink. And then comes out again. And my explanation, perhaps, of that was that there was some driftwood or something in the creek that night that filled up the sink and caused that thing to back up. And the only place you could put a bedroll out there would be in a low spot where the soil had settled up over the rocks, because that whole area is so rocky you couldn't put a bed out any place. It'd have to be in a place where there's some sediment. And then that creek would come up, the whole flow of the creek would all of a sudden spill into the sink, and that would probably be the answer to that one. But still, the Indians, Bertha Norman came up with some stories. She said that the Indians claimed that some white trappers a long time ago used that area where they would take the Indian women.
Let me just check the tape for a second, Walt. I hate to interrupt you, but I don't want to run out of tape.
Not too far from the cave.
What tribe did Bertha belong to?
She was a Shoshone.
And what was Doug's last name?
Doug Trosper, T-R-O-S-P-E-R. He's with the Army Engineers, and he's an Indian. He's Army, but he served with me for quite a few years, and served with me when we acquired the land for the Penobscots and Passamaquoddies in Maine. Mm-hmm. I had him come back there with me.
Okay. Where is the Dinwiddie Cave from the Dinwiddie Petroglyphs?
They are, as you approach the trail coming up, as you know, goes along the right side going up of the lake. And the petroglyphs then are off to the right, up on the cliff. The cave is almost straight ahead in another cliff that's within the canyon itself. And it's just to the above the lake, and it's almost dead ahead from that gate that you come into from there.
So how far would it be from the petroglyph?
About 600 yards, perhaps.
Can you draw a picture of the little people person that you saw there?
Yeah, pretty well. I'll sketch.
I want to mention here just so that anybody else that ever hears this, Walt is also a very skilled artist and sculptor.
I'll do that.
Walt, you used the word uncomfortable. Can you pick that apart a little bit?
Yeah, it is. It's a, in fact, it's almost like someone jabbing you under the ribs, but without actually doing it. Just, I felt like I was being pushed out of there, in a sense, without physical force. I was extremely uncomfortable, and I got more so as I proceeded. Perhaps that has to do with fear. But the thought of the little guy kind of got to me. And I've often thought that driving down the road, sometimes your mind will kind of drift off and you pick up an image, and then all of a sudden you kind of wake up. And whether this happened or not, I don't know. But this is, it was that kind of thing with me. All of a sudden, I remembered. I have a very vivid recollection of it. Whether as a physical thing, I can't say that, you know. But I went back with Doug, and we walked back into the cave, and everything else was there. The ledge that I saw the little man on was there. And so that kind of shocked me a little bit when I went back in the second time with Doug.
How big was the little man?
I would imagine, I visualize about 2.5 feet, I would say.
And was he wearing clothes?
No, not. He was kind of a skinny little fellow. I don't know whether he have anything at the bottom, because I see him as a squatting down with his feet kind of crossed and skinny and I can't recall any hair. I can't put anything on the top of his head.
You wouldn't then be able to tell whether or not he was wearing a kilt or
no,
a leather.
No, I couldn't
kilt.
Tell that. No.
What color was he?
Kind of a toasted brown, just about like toast. That's pretty darkly toasted. Definitely brown.
Compared to, we'll say an average Indian.
Much brown,
color?
Much darker.
And Mr. Miller, can you kind of identify him a little bit more?
Well, he's a rancher that had the ranch above Burris, and he'd been there for quite a few years. I don't recall the details of his name, and other than Mr. Miller. But gosh, he was an operator there for many years and leased land from the tribe for quite a few years.
Where's Bush?
Burris is just below the mouth of Dinwiddie. It's a small village. You have to go to Burris, and then from there you go up the road a little ways and then back up the creek, Dinwiddie Creek, and it's very near the mouth of Dinwiddie Creek.
So it's not Burris itself.
B-U-R-R-I-S, I think.
I misunderstood. I thought you were saying B-U-S-H.
Mm-hmm. B-U-R-R-I.
Okay, yeah, I remember where Burris is.
Okay.
Yeah. When were you there at Dinwiddie when you tried to camp out that night?
About, in the mid-60s.
Okay. Great, Walt. Thank you very much for that.
Thank
we'll continue
you.
on the other side of this tape, probably. Okay, Walt, while we were talking with the tape recorder not being on, I was reminded that Joe Medicine Crow had given me some other details about your departure from Dinwiddie Lakes when you tried to camp there. Would you tell about those now?
Yeah, well, I got back to my survival kit, and I got uncomfortable, and finally it got to the point I said, the hell with it. I just threw everything in the car, and I headed back for a motel
And really, I was just getting out of there, and I don't recall my driving from the time I left the lake till the time I got to Burris. I was just making tracks out of there.
Because of the very uncomfortable feeling?
Yeah, because I was uncomfortable. I was just very uncomfortable. That's hard to explain. You know, it's kind of like the superintendent. I wish I could remember the name of the superintendent at Fort Belmont. I feel bad that I don't, because that's been a long time ago, and he had a degree. I don't recall. I imagine as a B.A. But anyway, he was a college man, and we were talking about these various things, and he said that he had been in Billings. He said, "Now don't tell this to anybody." He said, "Because it embarrasses me." So maybe it's probably a good thing that I can't remember his name. But anyway, he said that he was driving back to Fort Belknap, and he came the shortcut through Hayes. And on the road between Hayes and the agency, there was a girl on the highway. And so he stopped and picked her up, a hitchhiker. And he was talking to her, and he was driving along talking to this girl, and then suddenly he turned around to her, and she wasn't there. So again, you know, did the superintendent, the question we talked about, did he just fall asleep at the wheel and dream all that, or is there something more to it?
Walt, was he a white man or an Indian?
He was Indian, and I don't recall exactly what the tribe that he belonged to, but I think he was probably Grovan.
Well, maybe we ought to ask an obvious question too. Are you white or Indian?
No, I'm white. I thought for a long time I was Indian, but I found out that I'm strictly a cross between a English and a German and a Scandinavian and a few others thrown in, but no Indian. And although there is a Woodcock Indian name, but that stems from my great uncle. That's on the Flathead Reservation. There's a family there. Their names were two Woodcocks, and looking back in the records, that suggests that name was taken from another name. And at that time, there was a fellow by the name of George Washington Woodcock, who was a distant cousin of mine, was there in 1865 and later, and he had been employed at the Indian Supply Depot at Council Bluffs before that, and so of course he was acquainted with Indians, and it would be natural for him to find Indian friends wherever he went after knowing Indians. And so there was a family then whose name was Two Woodcocks, and it's assumed then they took that name and the enrollment rather than taking an Indian name. And later the two was dropped, and then later, not too long ago in fact, the S was dropped. So the name on the Flathead Reservation is Woodcock, and there's a Woodcock subdivision there now from Inkashola Woodcock.
Thanks, Wolf.